after our return, we pulled our boat out, and it was so icy that we had a hard time to pull it out. We stored it down for the winter. We made up some packs and moved to our main cabin. We started tearing down the boiler house so as to have it ready to move and rebuild on a new shaft location, as we wanted to move the boiler and hoist as soon as there was not snow for sledding. We marked all the logs. This would make the assembling a lot easier. We also spent many days cutting wood, piling it in big piles to be hauled later with the dogs. A few days later, it started to snow. The first snowfall of the season, about 6 inches fell. This made good sledding after packed down. We needed fresh meat, as we had not had a taste of any for a long time. So we decided to go moose hunting. We had plenty of rabbits, spruce hens, and willow grouse, but these we did not class as fresh meat. The rabbits were so plentiful that we set 15 snares at night, and it was a good chance that we would have 10 rabbits in the morning. We fed our dogs mostly on rabbits, one each to a meal. We also had a good supply of oatmeal and cornmeal, and we would cook for them at least 3 times a week. Going moose hunting, we split and went in different directions. Mac, due to advanced age, stayed at home. Ira was lucky. He spotted the moose over on the next creek from the cabin, not over 3 miles. He killed and dressed it, then taking the liver, went back to get Mac and the dogs. It was a big, fat cow moose. Mac said it was a barren cow. A barren cow is one that had not had any calves for several years, maybe never. Nice and fat. This being the first moose meat Ira and I had ever eaten, it sure tasted wonderful. And the moose liver prepared by Mac was out of this world. I returned the next day, having spent one night with only a fire for warmth, as I carried no bedding of any kind. I saw one moose track, and it was several days old, or made right after the first snow. After all the meat was hauled into camp, we hauled the boiler and the hoist and the boiler house logs to new location, leaving Mac and Ira to reassemble the house and setting the boiler and hoist. I started the hauling wood. We had cut the wood on the hillside above the cabin, as it was quite steep. The hardest job was getting the sled up to the wood pile. Coming down, it was a case of rising to break all the way. In a few days, I had a big pile at the boiler house and one at the cabin. After everything was in shape, we started sinking our shaft. After reaching a depth of 3 feet, the water started seeping in. Mac said we better not go any further, but to wait a few days and let the sides freeze. This, he thought, would seal off the water. In about a week, we tried again. This time, we gained another 3 feet. The hole was now so deep, we had to use the hoist. We waited 10 days this time. Mac was running the hoist, Ira and I in the hole. The boiler was leaking and Mac had trouble keeping enough steam to lift the bucket, even half full of gravel. The water was now coming in faster than ever. We crimped the first 6 feet of the shaft to keep it from sloughing in. Then we waited another 2 weeks, but when we tried it again, we got down to about 9 feet, and we had to give it up. We could see now why the other man before us had sunk the hole on the side of the creek. They had no doubt tried the same thing as we were doing, but Mac had forgotten to tell us, so he did not mention this to us. I later on noticed that there was some holes started in the creek and they had been given up. As the boiler was getting worse and the rest of the gear old and not in too good a shape, including a frayed hoist cable, we gave this project up. Max said he knew of some creeks nearby. For the next summer, we could do some surface prospecting and maybe find enough pay to at least make another grub stake. As Ira and I had no intention of leaving the country after our first failure, we decided this was probably a good idea. It was now late in December, and as we had not heard any news or had any mail for months, no radio, of course, I never saw one in the kayako while I was there. We decided to go down to Bettles and spend Christmas there. Max said he had no desire to go, and with only four dogs, it would be too much of a load. The traveling on the river was good. We started in the morning from our lower cabin and went as far as Missouri Creek, about 22 miles, the first day. There was a good cabin at Missouri Creek, the cabin being located a quarter of a mile inland from the John River. We had missed it on our previous traveling on the river. Max drew us a map and we found it without much trouble. The next day we knew we would pass the camping place where I had left my gun. Having made the river trip three times, traveling at snail's pace, we knew every bend and landmark on the river. The empty sweet potato cans showed up plain, and my rifle was still leaning against the tree where I had left it 3 months earlier. As I have mentioned several times, the country was full of rabbits. For some reason, the flavor of the varnish, either the varnish or the wood in the stock, had some attraction for the pests. They had eaten away a great deal of the wooden stock. In spite of this destruction, I was glad to recover the gun, as it was in no other way harmed at all. We made a stop at Timber Creek Cabin, and the following day arrived at Bettles without incident. The Christmas celebration in Bettles was quite an affair. Everyone from the nearby creeks came into town to celebrate. Miners, prospectors, and trappers. Jack Dodd's roadhouse at Bettles was crowded to capacity, sleeping accommodations reduced to a point or making it necessary for many to sleep on the floor. As everyone carried their own bedding or sleeping bag, sleeping on their floor was not too much of an inconvenience. There was a poker game going at all times, as Jack's place during the Christmas season was operated on a 24-hour basis. In other words, the doors were never locked. Every evening there was a dance. The tables, chairs, and chairs were all removed from the dining room. But even so, the room was crowded. There was a few native women in Bettles, and the Nenehats never had a chance to be wallflowers throughout the evening. The temperature inside the outside being 40 degrees below zero, it was necessary to keep doors and windows closed. And as there was no fresh air entering, the room except when someone came in or went out of the door. The smell inside became a little rife. As some of the dancers had missed a lot of appointments with water and soap, this odor, mixed with tobacco smoke and stale homebrew beer and whiskey, made the atmosphere, when you first entered from the outdoors, a little undesirable. But after being inside for a while, the smell seemed to disappear. I guess one became immune to the odor. Christmas 1925 was, of course, during the probation era, but every miner, prospector, and trapper had their own still for making moonshine, also their own mash barrel and supplies for making beer. And I guess the some of the worst rot guts imaginable, and some real good whiskey. Some of the beer manufactured was so powerful that one bottle would set your head spinning. Harry and I would take a sociable drink once in a while, but never enough to call us drinkers. Even with all the liquid refreshments in town, it was a real peaceful Christmas. A few arguments, but no fights. A couple of old-timers would start an argument, sometimes over who could pan a pan of dirt the fastest and save all the colors, and who could snowshoe the longest distance in 10 hours. It usually ended up in the argument whom could make the best whiskey or moonshine. Each having a bottle of his own manufacturer, the bottle were then passed back and forth and sampled by each in turn. And before the argument was settled, they were both snoring in their chairs. After sleeping for a few hours, they usually started the argument again where they had left off. Having picked up what little mail there was for us and Mac, and buying a few odds and ends at the store, we decided to return up the river on December the 27th. There was very little daylight this time of the year, and we usually started out in the dark and camped at night in the dark. The only danger in traveling in the dark was running into overflow on the river. Also, in some real swift places on the river, the water never did freeze, regardless of temperature, all winter. An experienced or old lead dog will stop and refuse to take you into dangerous places, but our leader was young and therefore not experienced, and we had to be on the alert at all times. The morning of the 27th was clear and calm. The temperature warmed up some and to the 32 degrees below zero. Usually when the temperature rises, there is a chance of a snowstorm. We hoped to be home before the storm started, as it would cover our trail and made it make it hard traveling. We made good time as the dog had enjoyed a good rest. We had no trouble at all until we reached Missouri Creek. It had snowed up the river while we were down at Bettles, and we had a hard time locating the trail to the cabin. I walked ahead of the dogs. We had to cross the creek in order to reach the cabin, which was built on the other side. And when he was right in the middle of the creek, he broke through the ice. I left the dog sled and slid across the creek on my belly a short distance below. The water was about 4 feet deep, I guess it was the deepest place in the whole creek, and of course Ira was standing on the bottom. I helped him out and ran for the cabin a short distance away. Having kindling and wood handy, I started a fire in a few minutes, and when Ira came into the cabin, his clothes were frozen solid, and he could hardly walk. They were frozen solid from the waist down. He had to wait a while before being able to remove his clothes. Then he had to sit in the cabin with in his sleeping bag while his clothes dried over the stove. In spite of this cold bath, he never even caught a cold, which was lucky. It was snowing and blowing the next morning, and we knew that going would be for a rough on the river, as the places are open and windswept. The cabin being located in a sheltered place and lots of dry wood handy, we decided to spend the day there. We cut a big supply of wood, enough for future use, should we or some other traveler use the cabin. There is an unwritten code amongst the old timers in Alaska that a person occupying a cabin should before departure leave a supply of wood and some kindling ready for the next occupant. In a case like ours, having fallen through the ice and being soaking wet, if we had not provided wood and kindling before leaving on the trip down the river, it could have been a real tragedy. As it was in the below zero weather. However, to my disgust, this code of the trail has been abandoned by the present population of Alaska, with the exception of a few remaining old timers. While out cutting wood along the creek, we noticed a lot of open water. The creek itself was apparently fed by some warm springs and never froze during the winter. On closer examination, we could see a lot of small brook trout in the creek, the largest about 6 inches long. I went back to the cabin, found an old safety pin, fashioned a small hook from the pin, and a piece of string and a stick completed my fishing gear. With a small piece of bacon for bait, I was all ready for the trout. But I have never seen such hungry fish before or since. Every cast, I had a bite, but as there was no barb on my hook, I kept on losing the bait, and I had to replace this at all times. Finally, I had to quit. It was getting dark, having caught quite a mess of fish. But then I had enough fish for our dinner and for our breakfast in the morning. Ira and I always carried rabbit snares or snare wire in our sled bag. The old timers had told us to do so, as rabbits were plentiful and easy to snare. It was getting a good insurance for food for oneself and dogs in case of having to lay up during a storm after running short of supplies. While I was fishing, Ira set out 10 snares. Our thought was that if we had to spend another day or two at the Missouri Creek cabin, we would run out of dog fish for the dogs. The only time we fed the dogs dry fish was on the trail, as it was light to carry, and our supply that we carried on each trip was just enough to take us through without any unforeseen delay. Sure enough, the next morning the storm was even worse. I looked at his snares and I then had caught 6 rabbits. I fished again and caught about 30 fish. I guess we could have survived at Missouri Creek for a long time had it been necessary. The wind had died down the morning of the 31st, New Year's Eve, and we made a dash for what we called our home. Mac was glad to see us and to receive his mail. The people of Bethel had also given us a good supply of magazines, our reading materials prior to the trip being very limited. The magazines were sure appreciated by all of us. We sat up late telling Mac all the news that we had gathered on our trip. We were still sitting up at midnight when 1926 appeared. We all went outside the cabin at the stroke of midnight, and each one fired a shot from his rifle. This was the extent of our New Year's celebration, except for a cup of coffee and a piece of Mac's delicious pie. I must mention here that Mac could make a pie from dried fruit, surpassing pies that I have eaten from fresh fruit. New Year's Day, we spent at the lower cabin. I had to repair one of the dog harnesses. We had one dog that would chew the harness and also the tow line when he was not watched. We went back to the main cabin in the morning. We now had a lot of time on our hands, as we had given up prospecting for the time being. We went out and set some snares for lynx, but there was lots of tracks, but having absolutely no experience trapping and had no traps, we never caught a thing. We could snare all the rabbits we wanted, no skill needed to catch them. Ira and I decided to each make a sleeping robe or rabbit skin. We each had a double sheet blanket and lots of skins would be easy to obtain. We had not saved any skins during the winter, so had to catch enough rabbits for our robe. We caught enough in a few days, dried the skins, removing most of the fat and flesh as much as possible. We then squared the skins, in other words, we cut off the legs and other uneven parts of the skin. Laying the skins on one half of the blanket, we tacked it in place with needle and thread, then laying the other half on top and quilting the two together, it made something like a light quilt. It proved out to be real warm until some of the skins tore and left places without any skin covering at all. It also had not too pleasant a smell, especially when it got a little damp or wet. Ira and I made another trip down to Missouri Creek for the purpose of fishing. This time we had real fishing hooks, as Mac had an assortment with him. The days were now beginning to lengthen considerably, and it was nice traveling. We stayed at the cabin for 3 days. Then we went back, as we had caught so many fish that they were getting hard to catch. I guess we have caught nearly all of them. The next part of this story will be part two of the book and will be titled Joining the Wilkins Arctic Expedition, Traveling by Dog Team to Point Barrow. Unbeknownst to us up on John River, in other parts of Alaska, at Nenana and Fairbanks, there was considerable activity going on, as an expedition was assembling by the Detroit Aviation Society. Society to be known as the Detroit Arctic Expedition, headed by Captain Hubert Wilkins. Two airplanes were purchased in the States and sent in on the Alaska steamship boat, then shipped on the Alaska Railroad to Fairbanks. The planes were dismantled before leaving the States and reassembled after reaching Fairbanks. The intent was for Wilkins, acting as navigator and commander of the expedition, and having with him a pilot and a co-pilot, also acting as mechanic, were to use a trimotor airplane and fly over the North Pole to Spitsbergen, Norway. At the same time, an overland expedition was being assembled at Nenana. This overland expedition, headed by Alexander Malcolm Smith, as leader, a long-time Alaskan with unlimited knowledge for the winter traveling in Alaska. For this reason, he was chosen for this assignment. The expedition shipped to Nenana three Fortune snowmobiles and a number of double-end sleds. The design and construction of these snow vehicles may have looked good on the drawing board, but their usefulness in the rough ice of the Canada River was absolutely nil. The snow motors, as they were called, were powered by a Fortune engine. The locomotion power consisted of two cylinders about 8 feet long, welded onto the cylinders for spiral grousers, in other words, built like two giant corkscrews. The whole assembly being built rigid with no shock absorbent features at all, the machines, after climbing a rough surface, for instance like a chunk of ice, would go straight out, the front end suspended high in the air. Then, when the point of balance was reached, crushed down forward, jarring every bone in the operator's body, and as it happened, break the front motor support. In addition to three snow motors, the expedition had bought one team of 13 Siberian dogs from Leonard Stepla of Nome. This team was to be the emergency means of transportation for the expedition. The snow motors had to be given up after a short trip. A few miles from the start, and in order to continue the overland expedition, additional dogs were secured, and two drivers were hired from Tanana. Two teams were bought in addition to the Siberians, and one team and driver was hired at Tanana. This team and driver was later to return to Tanana, bringing the other two drivers back home. The order to turn back on the divide between John River and the Anaktuvuk River. The purpose of the overland expedition was to arrive at Barrow ahead of Captain Wilkins, establish a radio station there, and transmit weather information to Captain Wilkins prior to his takeoff on his first flight to Barrow. The radio equipment included a Kohler light lamp with batteries for power. The Kohler plant, being heavy, required one team of dogs. It was loaded on a Yukon sleigh, equipped with a jeep pole, the driver guiding the sleigh, riding a short pair of skis. In addition to the above-mentioned equipment, There was the usual trail gear, food, tents for the men, gun ammunition. It also required large amounts of dog food. At the time the expedition left Canada, there were 4 teams and a total of 43 dogs. Before traveling very far, the men realized that the loads were too heavy. Therefore, one team of 11 dogs was purchased from Whiskey Bill or Whiskey Jack at purchase. Also purchased with the team was a real good trading sleigh. The Whiskey Jack team, as it was called, were all big Yukon River Huskies, but they were not to be trusted when your back was turned, as I found out later. There were now a total of 54 dogs in 5 teams. Every part of Alaska back in 1926 was traveled by dog teams, the only mode of transportation in the wintertime. That is prior to the appearance of the airplane. The dog team trails were usually staked on the river in the fall. There was also cutoffs or winter trails cut through timber, usually blazed trails, connecting rivers and villages, making it unnecessary for the fellow travelers to follow the much longer route on the rivers. The expedition cut across from the Yukon River below Birches over into the Kaikuk River. Coming into the Kaikuk near Alatna village. From there the river was followed to Bettles. At Bettles it was decided that another dog team would be necessary in order to carry additional supplies as far as the head of John River. Some of the dogs, having traveled all the way from Nenana, were now showing signs of being somewhat tired and slowing down a bit. At Bettles there was a Japanese by the name of Minnie the Jap. He owned a team of 11 dogs. Alex Smith made a deal with him to accompany the expedition. The deal was that he would be hired by the day and could stay employed as long as he wanted, if possible as far as the coast on the Arctic Ocean. This Minnie agreed to. The dog population was now increased to 65 dogs or 16. After left Bettles and started up John River, there were also 9 men in the expedition. They arrived at our camp at the mouth of Canyon Creek, March 16, 1926. This was to be the termination of my stay in the Kaikuk. It was late in the evening when our dogs started to raise the devil. Ira and I rushed out the cabin door to see what the family was going on that made the dogs so mad. We knew there was something coming up the river, or maybe the dogs smelled the moose. Their noses were all pointed downstream. We went out on the river bank to look as the river ran straight downstream for about half a mile in front of the cabin. We could not believe our eyes when we looked. There was dog team seemingly all over the river, all heading our way. There's a correction to be made on this tape. Coming up the river were 8 men. Previously stated it was 9 men. It should be 8. Thank you. short time, the dog teams arrived at our cabin. The first one to introduce himself was Alexander Smith. With him in the party were the following men: Earl Rossman, photographer for Cassie News, also official expedition photographer; Robert Watsky, radio operator; Herbert Anderson, dog team driver and all-around handyman. The drivers from Canada were Edgar Callan, Charlie Harper, and a native by the name of Chris. I can't remember his full name. Also, many of the Japs from Bettles. I found out later his home was at Weissman. After the introduction, the men started to set up the two tents required to accommodate the 8 men. Unhitching the dogs, and by that time, Max had a big kettle full of coffee ready, and everyone surely enjoyed it. Smith had heard about us while in Bettles. He had also heard about our failure reaching bedrock with our shaft. While the drivers were unharnessing their dogs, Smith and Rossman were in the cabin talking to Max. Alexander Smith, being a Scotsman, the same as Max, the two of them headed off from the start. As we had a large cook stove in the cabin, Max prepared dinner for the whole group. He cooked in the cabin and they ate in the tent, as the cabin was too small to accommodate such a large crowd. After dinner, Smith related all the trials and experiences of the expedition from the very start from Inanna. This I have already described earlier in the narrative. Smith had tried to hire another driver at Bettles, as 3 of the drivers and 1 team of dogs were to return to Tanana upon reaching the summit. This summit, or the pass, according to Smith, was only 2 days away from our cabin. Unable to obtain the driver at Bettles and having 4 teams to take to drive, this meant that there would be no one left free to break trail with snowshoes ahead of the dogs if such a thing should be necessary. And with the heavy loads of equipment, etc., Smith knew that this would have to be done at times as we progressed down Anacubic River, and how right he was. Smith therefore asked Byron me if we would be interested in making the trip to Barrow. Ira said no at once, having no desire to see Barrow, also feeling that there would be a lot of hardship on such a journey. As I look at it now, after looking back through the years, he was using good sense. Neither one of us had the proper clothing and sleeping gear for a trip across the Arctic. Smith finally talked me into joining the Arctic expedition, and I signed a contract dated March 17, 1926. The contract inserted in the book. But our mutual agreement, which was made verbally, was that if I so desired and was not satisfied, I could return with the team from the head of John River. Minutes Jeff had by this time decided that he would also turn around with the other team. The following day we started up the river. I did not drive a team at the time, as there was plenty of drivers as yet. The traveling was slow. Everybody walked, or at times ran alongside the sled. There was a lot of places on the river where the wind and drifting snow had polished the ice just like a mirror. And if the dog stopped, it was almost impossible to start the heavy sled going again, as the dogs could not get a foothold. The first night we camped, I had a chance to look over the outfit. What I did see did not impress me very favorably. I saw at a glance a lot of the useless equipment. When I say useless, I mean as far as practical on an expedition was concerned. There was enough ammunition to fight a small war, and enough guns to grip a small army, and hundreds of other articles, not only in duplicate, but some in triplicate. Later, when we had to lighten that load, we discovered in one sled a case of ammunition oversized that we did not even have a gun for. But I did observe there was a shortage of food, especially staples as usually carried by prospectors and miners. They were not plentiful. Some fancy canned items were in the supplies. There was also a definite shortage of dried dogfish. There were, however, several 50-pound cans of tallow. Tallow, in other or other fat, is always an important item in feeding a sled dog in order to balance his diet. After we had made camp, this was my first day with the expedition, and knowing that we could use some rabbits to supplement the dog food, I suggested that as there was plenty of guns and ammunition in camp, some of us should go on try a little hunting as long as we had daylight. Smith thought it was a wonderful idea. The drivers from Canada, Herb Anderson and myself, five men in all, hunted until dark. It was too dark to see the guns. We arrived back in camp with all the rabbits each one could carry. I don't remember the exact count, but I believe between 50 and 60. According to Alex Smith's estimate, the second day out should bring us to the headwaters of the river, or the Anatuba Pass. But later in the day, we made a camp at the timberline. We camped in the last stand of spruce timber south of the Endicott Range. Many of the Japs, having previously made a trip to the headwaters, informed us that we still had quite a distance to travel before reaching the summit for the Anatuba River. Many of the Japs was a small, fiery fellow, about 5 feet tall and weighing, I should guess, less than 100 pounds. Instead of skis, when guiding the sled with the jeep pole, he used what was called a jeep board. This board was at that time used a lot when freighting in the interior, freighting heavy loads, especially in the timber. Loads that could not be guided by the bow on the back of the sled. The board was built in order of a miniature toboggan and about 30 inches long and 12 inches wide, the front end being attached to the tow line with a small cable, probably a quarter inch cable, and a snap. When traveling on bare ice, the board is screwed from side to side. Many would then hook his legs over the pole and hangs suspended by his head to the hands and legs like a monkey. We had many good laughs at the performance, and I don't believe I have ever met a fella as good natured as he was, always in a good humor, even when things did not go just right, and this was often on this trip. After leaving the timber line, there was a gradual climb to the summit, but not very steep. Very little snow, mostly glare ice, and the wind blowing so hard it would push the sled and dog clear across the river and against the bank. The temperature being 20 below zero, it was mighty cold. At one place I had to help one of the drivers to make some slight repairs on one of his dog harnesses. I took my hunting knife and laid it on the ice while I was tying it up in a piece of rope. The wind started the knife sliding. I tried to run to catch it, but it was impossible to stand up. Unless one was holding on to something, you could not stand on your feet. I never did find my knife. In the afternoon, we crossed the divide and into the Anacubic watershed. The interesting feature of the summit is that there is a creek of fair size. This I observed from the two glaciers coming in from the east. This creek splits on the divide, one branch or channel forming the head of John River and the other the head of Anacubic River. We made camp about a mile down the Anacubic River in a patch of good-sized willows. Some Eskimos had also camped there many years prior, as they were remnants of three sod igloos. The wind had subsided some, but the temperature had dropped to minus 29 degrees. We had one thermometer fastened on the rear of one of the sleds, as Smith had to keep record of the weather and the temperature, morning and night. This camp now marked the termination of three of the drivers and one dog team from Tanana. Minnie Jaff had also decided that there was a lot more comfort awaiting him at home, being a married man and having several children. It was a great disappointment to Alex Smith when he learned of Minnie's decision to return. Since leaving Canyon Creek, I had laid awake sometimes at night trying to make up my mind whether to continue with the expedition or go back with the return party. I finally made up my mind. As far as I could see, the expedition was headed for a very tough, if not disastrous, future. The loss of the two dog teams meant that the other four teams would have to carry the additional load. Of course, it would ease up on the supplies. Four men left to feed and about 20 dogs, but I still could not see the folly of continuing. When I informed Alex Smith of my plans to return with the boys, he sat down on the sled and cried like a baby. I felt so damn sorry for the man, as he had his whole heart, set on reaching Barrow before Wilkins, and the deadline for our arrival drawing closer at all times. The plan was to be at Barrow not later than April 1st. After watching Alex sleep for a few minutes, I slapped him on the back and said, "Okay, Alex, I'll stay. If the rest of you boys can make it, I can, and I'm game. As game as the rest." When I said that, Alex jumped from the sled, ran over to me and gave me a big bear hug and said it was the happiest moment in his life. At least the happiest one he could remember. When I mentioned that I would continue, we decided with the additional load we would rest the dogs one day before starting out again. We also had to sort out the equipment and gear, anything that we could spare we gave to the returning drivers. I gave them one of the tents. We had no fuel to use for the wood stove, that there was only small willows to be found from this point to the coast. This information was wrong, as we found out later. Then with your own camping gear and bedding, our load did not increase to a great extent. Also, our load was lightened some each day as we progressed using up dog food. From our campsite, looking up the sides of the mountain, we saw mountain sheep or dall sheep on both sides of the valley, not only a few, but hundreds. This was too much for our hunting blood. In a few minutes, we were climbing to try and reach a point above the sheep. Charlie Harper and I went together, Burke and Callum made up the other party. The two parties climbed the opposite sides of the valley. Charlie and I scored first. We shot two nice rams. Cutting the heads off, we started the cartons sliding down the mountain, and they did not stop before reaching the valley floor, way below. The meat was a little bruised, but also tenderized on the way down. The other two boys also shot one ram each, so now we had some real nice meat. The only fresh meat we had for some time. We had meat for dinner that evening, also meat for breakfast the next morning, and it sure tasted wonderful. Even as heavy loaded as our sleds were, we divided the meat on the four sleds. We could feed some of the meat to our dogs and save our dry fish for a later day. The ten and our boys did not want any meat, as they decided to stay at our camp after we left and hunt for a few days. This they did with real success, as I found out some years later. I was assigned the Whiskey Jack team. When we started the next morning, Charlie Harper, having driven his team, or driven this team the whole trip, helped me hitch me up. Charlie told me to carry the blackjack, or blacksnake, whip in my hand at all times when handling this bunch of brutes. One of the dogs had bit him in the hand, and another one tried to make a meal out of the calf of his leg a few days before. The butt end of the blacksnake whip is loaded with buckshot, and one could knock a dog out with it with ease. This he said he had to do several times. I also had to do the same thing at times later on. I also inherited the Yukon sled with the jeep hole loaded with the Kohler life plan and miscellaneous other gear. This was by far the heaviest load of the two sleds. On top of this, I also had the largest portion of the sheep meat, but also had the biggest and strongest dogs. And without doubt, I had the meanest team of the expedition. We bid the boys goodbye and went on our way. It gives Polly a funny feeling in the pit of the stomach when he severs the last link of civilization. And to us, the four boys and the two teams were this last link. The traveling on the upper Anacubic River was good, and we made fairly good time. At one spot, not far from the summit, we spotted an object on the riverbank. At closer inspection, it turned out to be a poling boat. There was the initials JN carved in the bow of the boat. At least someone had been at this godforsaken spot before us. I found out later, after arriving at the Arctic coast, that two fellows, Jack Nygaard and Jack Smith, had dragged the boat over the divide from the John River, planning to float down the Anacubic and onto the coast. Finding the river too shallow, detached the boat and continued on foot, reaching the Arctic coast safely. As we left the mountains, the depth of snow increased. It was now a case of one man on snowshoes breaking trail ahead of the dogs nearly all the time. Then finally we had to leave the dogs and sled behind, and three men breaking trail a few miles ahead and then returning for the dogs and the four sleds. We always had to leave two men to watch the dogs, as they would start a fight on the spur of the moment. If no one was there when the fight started, they would pick on a dog, and it would cripple or kill a dog in a few minutes. We had a couple of dogs killed in this way later, and also some cripples. Of all the dogs in our team, the small Siberian for the gamest and of the best disposition. We could always leave this team, never having to worry about them fighting. Alex Smith drew the Siberian team, and he was always in the lead. My load being the heaviest, needing a good trail, I was in the rear, or sometimes the snow was so deep and soft that the man's snowshoes would sink down 2 feet, and a small Siberian dog appeared to be going through a canal, and only their level of the snow on the side. Herb Anderson and I, being the younger members of the expedition, in addition to them every day and taking turns helping to break trail, we also had to do most of the chores. Every evening we had to do such things as securing willows for the fire, you know, where to cook the dog food, our dried fish, and the sheep meat had long since been fed. We had to cook oatmeal, cornmeal, and tallow together. The dogs were getting thinner every day, so we knew that it would not be long before some of the dogs would be unable to pull the sled. Herb and I became real pals on the trip. It seemed that something separated us from the others, Smith, Rossman, and Watsky, were more on their own. This may have been due to the differences in ages and occupations. No one had an argument on the whole trip, and as we were working under the most trying circumstances imaginable, and the dogs in the face every day, I think if I look back, by now we had run out of room for anything, and it's pretty. A younger person, more than anyone. I'm speaking, but I really suffered not having any food. I asked him if he was a big chunk of the tobacco. Real nice and sweet. Swallowed all the saliva. He had given up. Everything around me was in. My head was buzzing, and I got not having to throw up. You could die, can I? That's not good. Having a better one. In my head, looking at this and that. As of this day, I've never tasted anything. After every side of the up. Along the way, we were traveling to so as to have some. We also had and 4 inches long, like sealing wax, a thing fruit. Scraping it. It was one started even what he learned. One day we passed spot open in the river. He wanted to stop. And if he could not, or by me, we would shoot some for ourselves. He said we were getting full, therefore, could not do. long way. The surveys and the maps printed. Time for some. The guesswork. Also, not having any family, but impossible for Santa or the rest of us in our position. The only thing that is our belief is we lost even that we were children. The only thing I felt we were chosen here can be the some of our dogs. Fully, but stand up by themselves. Get around. Death. He relieved himself on the floor. The dog behind him fell on the floor. His fur cap one day, he could receive it in the team following. The cap so that there was not even a killing the weakest, dogs cutting them up and feeding. But the dogs, or the ones we killed, were so poor. Were nothing but skin and bone. For learning, for food value. My healthy, safe, and innocent. All our dogs onto this leg, and then barely food. Earlier in the show, you guys could have done it. The Siberian dog caught his foot in it and broke his tongue. He was above his foot. Sandy wanted to see it. Now, I'm out of it. The dog made a sprint. The dog here. Dog on his leg. And he rode the pedal. The dog runs. He's easily. They I got healed, but instead I had another life. The dog was breathing, and just then the driver sent it up. We filled it. The dog got other plans. The condition right. That is a small wireless with us operated on the battery. And it's not a thing. They couldn't a message to send out messages. But had no way of the battery went dead. We filled it into radio again. Now, something like magneto had to be handled. in order to operate. It takes our instincts to be trained. The light falling out of what? Those meters. Good. That. You finally give operating the wireless with a trip. That gives us no use time. And I'll continue on the next one. Chapter 3 of the book. Maybe.
I think you better wait.